the facts and then followed the facts to their what he thought was their logical conclusion. And it doesn't matter whether it's his best friend that he's disagreeing with or someone that he doesn't care much for. He's completely objective, I think, in all of his battles and crusades. He just I guess nowadays they say tell it like it is.
That's sort of what I meant in my observation from the book thus far, when I said consistently inconsistent. You don't seem to follow a party line very well. And even when you reach a liberal cause, you don't appear to always be liberal.
But he's consistent to himself.
Such as what, for instance?
Well, I was afraid you were going to say that. Let me recall one while Joe asks that question.
Keeping in mind Larry is limited to the first half of the book only.
Yes. Joe's read the second half. Senator, anyone who has had an illustrious career in public service in you is certainly entitled to write a biography in which throughout he comes off as the shining knight. And I think perhaps in your case that was a particularly easy thing to do. But was there ever a time in your career of public service that you felt that you were tarnished by the things that you had done in retrospect, perhaps even? We see none of that in your book, if that was the case.
Well, I don't think of anything in my public relations or my relation to what I was working for, whether it was a newspaper or a government. Some of these battles were lost for time, but most of them were ultimately won. Now, I would say that, let's take Vietnam. When I fought this, I think I was the first person in public life to denounce our entry to the war. I'm not a pacifist. I was a rootin' tootin' supporter of World War I and World War II, which I felt were necessary for us to go into. I felt that if we'd not gone to the aid of Britain in World War I, it would have been conquered first by the Kaiser and then by Hitler, and that would have been disastrous to the democracies of the world. And so I supported those wars, but the war in Southeast Asia struck me as utterly without any justification whatsoever. We had no vital interest in the United States was in jeopardy. We had no business to barge halfway around the world and inject ourselves into an Asian quarrel. And actually, all those actions of ours, while we pretended, all our leaders pretended that we were fighting aggression, we were actually the aggressors. And this is something that even to this day, most Americans don't realize. Most Americans don't realize that the Tonkin Gulf fraud was a deliberate deception on the part of Lyndon Johnson. And although I didn't know that when I voted against the Tonkin Gulf resolution, we none of us did that, I just felt it was wrong. And I think by this time, most public opinions come to that point of view. So while it doesn't always follow that the passage of time and the course of events vindicates your stand, you can fight a battle and never be proved right by public opinion. I think this is one example. And the same was true with my battle for the legislature here against the absentee interests that were taking everything out and putting nothing back. And similarly, although I'm a conservationist, a fervent one, I think some of our conservationists are extremists, and I think the actions of the Sierra Club and the Friends of the Earth and Wilderness Society in blocking the pipeline and now in trying to ram this 80 million acre withdrawal are destructive of our best interest. And I'm concerned for the interests of the people of Alaska, inevitably. And I think that time will prove that.
You mentioned, Senator, in your opening statement that you felt that Alaskans should resist this land grab, as you've phrased it. How, as a practical matter, would you suggest that that be done?
Well, ultimately, the decision will be made by the Congress. This presentation of Rogers Morton has to be passed upon by the Congress, and I think we've got to conduct a campaign of education and a campaign of lobbying, which will show the members of Congress how detrimental this will be to the Alaska interest and to the national interest, and that it's completely unnecessary. Now, I'm not too optimistic about the result of that effort, because the average member of Congress is perfectly willing to be as generous as he pleases up in Alaska. But if a situation occurred in his own state, where there's a conflict between conservation and some vital economic project, he would act differently. But I think we've got to try and present our case. And this is the democratic way, try to persuade, and hope we can get the votes to modify this proposal. And the thing that is so annoying in this business, I say that the whole thing is unnecessary. We can have economic development, and we can still not despoil any piece of our scenery, not pollute any river, not destroy any piece of wildlife, but these extremists don't believe that. They want to set everything aside and paralyze it forever. Now, as I say, let's suppose in the course of the next few years, which is inevitable, as we run short of not only energy, sources of power, but strategic minerals, and yet we know they're under our saw, and yet we're stopped from developing them. That doesn't make sense, does it? Well, that's what's happening. That's what's going to happen unless we reverse this.
I was looking for a quote. I'm sure that I have it underlined someplace here, Senator, but what you're talking about right now, I think, is representative of what I mean, and I'm not going to, if you say I should discard it, I'm perfectly willing to discard it. A true liberal, to me, wouldn't be making quite the remarks about the environmentalists that you are making, and wouldn't have been so fervently for Rampart, wouldn't be so quick to criticize the Interior Secretary on his recommendations of today. He would have been more like the man who came to Alaska when he was working for the Interior Department, as you did, and argued to save the fish in the Russian River. I think that this is a... you say you are a conservationist, yet you are so strongly for this development. You're so strongly for Rampart. I think that's an inconsistency in a true...
No, because neither of those projects do any damage to the environment. Now, one of the things while I was in...
You'd admit that there are a lot of people who disagree with you in regard to Rampart on that.
Yes, I do. I realize that. And I think that I don't share their view, and I don't share their set of facts. I think that if the Yukon Flats were flooded, there would be plenty of other nesting grounds for ducks and geese in Alaska, and I think we could find them. And I think we need low-cost power for our economy. I mean, they keep our wheels going. We are going to be short of energy in the next, what we are right now. This is a serious impairment to the interests of the people. And I think the interests of the people should be paramount and superior to the interests of the four-footed creatures. Now, when I was in the Senate, one of the things I worked to achieve was to save a very natural phenomenon called the Indiana Dunes. The Indiana Dunes are a very interesting formation, the southern end of Lake Michigan. They extended back 2 or 3 miles. They were filled with exotic plants and flowers, and they were gradually being invaded and destroyed from the west by the cities of Gary and Hammond, which were moving in, destroying them, polluting the lake. And when I went there, they had destroyed several miles of these, and Lake Michigan was filled with rusting material. The air was filled with acrid smoke from these factories. And there was a specific example of the kind of damage that reckless development did to our environment. And that was something I fought, and we stopped it. We had lost those few miles of dunes, but we saved the rest of the dunes. So I've been on record, and I fought for all these national parks that were set aside, Cape Cod, Mesa Verde, all the others, so that my record is very consistent on this point. But here in Alaska, these people have gone to extreme lengths. They've gone beyond what's reasonable, and they have made allegations which do not stand up. Now, one of the arguments against the pipeline was to interfere with the migration of the caribou. Well, no one has been able to demonstrate to me that the caribou are seriously going to be injured, that after they've crossed the many hundreds of miles of northern Alaska, they strike the pipeline, and if they can't jump over it, that their future is lost. They can just go back where they came from if we can't devise some method by which they can jump over the pipeline. And this is just as far-fetched as the allegation made at the time of the the Kenai moose range, that the moose would be destroyed. I knew that wouldn't be the case, and the habitat wouldn't be, and it wasn't. And as I say, they make these wild statements, which attract a lot of attention and win a lot of converts, and they should be challenged for their veracity and their unsoundness. Now, as I say, I have been a conservationist all my life. As governor, I stopped the slaughter of the bald eagle, which had been going on, which was a monumental piece of folly, but which represented the thinking of the people of Alaska at that time. As you know, you'll find that in the book. And so that I have a pretty consistent record. But I think in this particular case, these clubs, these societies, are manned by extremists. Now, at the time of the Kenai Moose Range, there was one conservation society that didn't join them, the Isaac Walton League. And he differed with the others. But most of them were on the other side, as they are now.
I have a question that sort of relates here, then I want you to unload some of yours, Joe. And Sonny also wants us to break, but this question first. The amendment to the Native Land Claim Settlement Act that made possible what Morton recommended mm-hmm. today, you said at the start of our show that if you had been in the Alaska delegation were Stevens and Gravel, at the time the amendment came, well, I guess it was Young, wasn't it, that you would have fought this vigorously. Mm-hmm. Well, you monitor what's happening very closely. Are you certain they even had a reasonable awareness of the ramifications of this amendment?
I think it's possible to lessen the era of our delegation that they didn't realize how far it might go. But they should have been aware of that. They should have. That was their business. That's what they were there for. It was completely irrelevant. It had nothing to do with Native claims. It was just inserted as a separate provision that in addition to setting aside land for the Natives and giving them a vast sum of money and so forth and so on, there was this other provision. It should have been the subject of entirely separate legislation and which could have been studied. But I think that this is one of the things the Alaska delegation will have to explain to the voters.
Do you think very much of our Alaska delegation right now?
Well, I think it would be an embarrassing question for me to answer that because it would tend to indicate that I thought it was better in my day, and I don't think that would be a very modest...
It was, Senator, it was.
Do you think Senator Gravel is a very good senator?
Well, I have a reference to Senator Gravel in my book.
One line. It's not a whole lot.
One page.
One page.
Okay.
And I think that would be an answer to your question.
Congressman Young.
Well, he's new and young, and I don't think you can judge a man on his record in the first few months in Congress. I'm prepared to let Young see what he can do when he's been there a bit longer. I don't think it's been conspicuously good or bad. I think that, and it's not to be expected that a man coming there for the first time can make a record in the first few weeks or first few months.
You've known Ted Stevens for some time, yeah. However, and he's been there a while. How effective do you believe he is for...
Well, I think he's, I would say that he's the best man in our delegation.
Our guest is former Senator Ernest Greening, former territorial governor, with us also Dick Grohl, Joe LaRocca. Sonny, what a caller want to know, and I wanted to have the page on Gravel read. We've decided in here we have a consensus from this illustrious group, and they suggest that the fellow go buy a book, and it's available at Borealis Bookstore.
You cannot call or not call back and get mad at me.
Okay.
I just autographed 250 of them.
There's quite a crowd over there.
No, have you had Jay's autograph yet?
No, and I want the autograph, but I agree. It's a full page. It's one page out of...
the photo.
No, it's one page out of 543.
Well, that ought to tell you something.
Joe, there's a part of the book that I haven't got to yet that intrigued you.
Before we get to that, Larry, I'd like to follow up on your last question concerning the addition of the amendment.
We have some questions from callers, too.
Now, the addition of the amendment concerning this
land withdrawal in the Native Land Claims Act. It's been my feeling, Senator, that the reason that amendment is in the Act is because, as a practical matter and as a political matter, the Act would not have passed without it, much as, for instance, the amendment to the Alaska Pipeline Act this year, exempting the Trans-Alaska Pipeline from the requirements of NEPA, was passed only because a wholly irrelevant amendment was introduced and passed with the bill, and that was the one, for instance, concerning the Federal Trade Commission authorizations. In other words, what I'm saying wasn't it, don't you think it's at least part of it perhaps is the fact that the Alaska delegation and those proponents of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline were prepared to give that up in order to get what they wanted, and that it was
no,
a portion of the...
No, because they've said subsequently they're very much a fan of this provision. Stevens tells me that the delegation was sort of bamboozled into it by in conference, that some strong pressure came from conservationists in the House, but they're very much opposed to it. If they're very much opposed to it now, I think the question may be asked, why weren't they sufficiently alert at the time to fight its passage, which they didn't do?
So my question then is, did they not fight its passage? Because if they did, they then would not have prevailed in that part of the Act that they wanted.
I don't think it has anything to do with the Native claims. It's an entirely different issue.
Let's take the questions, and then we'll go to that part about the legislature that you have there in question, Joe. Sonny?
There are some people listening down in Healy, Larry, who called in tonight asking if Senator Green likes the settlement with the oil companies as proposed by Governor Egan.
Did you hear that, Senator?
Well, I'm not familiar with its details. I think the important question that Governor Egan had to decide was that the state would get an adequate part of the revenues, and I think he secured that. And to that extent, I think it's a satisfactory settlement, but I'm not prepared to talk about it because I don't know its details.
Another, Sonny.
Caller didn't remember where it happened or who it was, but asked if you had testified at a trial for some militants who blew up a building somewhere in the lower 48.
I testified for various people who were opposed to the draft and who were opposed to war because I felt that that the draft was a violation of the 13th Amendment, and I've done that on several occasions.
I was going to toss in here. Yes. You believe that Nixon is trying very hard to keep something going for him in Indochina in the way of a war, don't you?
I think this is an entirely different subject, a very important one. I think it is absolutely shocking that after Nixon was forbidden to use troops down there, which the Congress did, of course, Nixon announced 11 months ago that he'd end the war, and he said also that he'd ended with honor. Well, nothing could have been more devoid of honor in those closing days of the war when we rained death and destruction on the peasant people of Cambodia after shelling them for 12 months and lying about the American people. So there was no honor there.
Do you believe that Nixon lied to the American people about that?
No question about it.
Well, there's a local attorney who, when I say President Nixon lies with regularity, wants us to point to specifics.
Well, I'll to give you a specific. He told the American people at the conclusion of 12 months of bombing that we had preserved our neutrality toward Cambodia. And, of course, this was a direct violation of the truth because we'd been bombing Cambodia without any sanction of Congress, without any declaration of war, with deliberate concealment, not only from the American people, but even from the Congress. This was a deliberate deception, which to this day nobody denies. In fact, Nixon stated that he'd do it again.
And this isn't like you aren't getting this from newspaper or magazine reporting. These are from his speeches. You're hearing his pearly words themselves say these things,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's absolutely true.
So we, the American public, aren't being conned by the press into thinking the man's lying.
But
the man is lying with his own mouth to
it. If you look at Nixon's past record, you will find that long before Watergate, he was indulging in the same shady practices in his earlier campaign, his campaign against Jerry Voorhees for the Congress in 1944, his campaign against Helen Hagen Douglas for the Senate in 1950, and his gubernatorial campaign against Pat Brown in California in 1962. And this has all been brought out in a recent book by Frank Mankiewicz called Perfectly Clear, Nixon from Whittier to Watergate. In California in 1962, a letter ostensibly arising in the Democratic Democratic State Organization was sent to some 700,000 Democratic voters, which called attention to and deplored the left-wing tendencies of Governor Pat Brown and the left-wing character of his associates, and asked for a vote on the subject. This letter did not originate in Democratic headquarters. It originated in Republican headquarters and was drafted with the approval of Richard Nixon, and in which case there was no denial whatsoever. It was admitted and was so found by Judge Byron Arnold, who tried the case when the Democrats got wise to it and took it to court. This is all a matter of record.
Sonny.
And at that time, he had the same associates that he had Watergate. Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Kalmbach, and all the rest. Same old gang.
Sonny.
What kind of a population increase would you like to see in Alaska, Senator?
None.
So that will make the caller happy. Some caller asked if you would be specific in naming a time when resource development such as mining was compatible with wildlife populations.
I see nothing incompatible with wildlife if mining is properly controlled and we don't do it as carelessly as it's been frequently done in the past. The description that I gave of the western end of the dunes in Indiana was an example of very sloppy performance. There's no reason why rusting iron should have been thrown into Lake Michigan, why the fumes of acrid burning should pollute the air. These things can be controlled, and they should be made mandatory whenever an industry of that kind is given a license to operate. Now, to say that in this vast area of 83 million acres, an occasional mine is going to ravage the landscape is perfectly ridiculous. Why can't it be? It doesn't have to pollute the air or the landscape. And we've got to have this economy if we're going to subsist.
Sonny.
A caller asked if you are familiar with Edgar Snow and his book, Journey to the Beginning, and she wanted to know if you knew Mr. Snow, and if so, what is your opinion of him?
I'm sorry, I don't know the man of the book.
One other question from a caller. The caller wanted to know if, first pointing out that you're very knowledgeable about Alaska and what affects Alaskans, and asked if our legislators in Washington contact you frequently to ask for advice.
No, they do not.
Joe, you have a portion of the book that that I haven't read that intrigued you.
Well, again, I wanted to touch on another point that we've already discussed. Senator, do you think that the deliberate deception of the public by a president and his administration is ever justified on the basis of national security? Do you think it's ever justified on that basis?
Well, ever is a very inclusive word. I can imagine some circumstances where, for a time being, a president might conceal certain negotiations, certain sensitive matters, but certainly not for long. I think the public has a right to know. I think this is basic to our philosophy, and it's one of the things that Nixon has violated consistency. Secrecy has become almost an adjunct of this administration, and I think it's all wrong. I think that before very long, everybody has a right to know what our government is doing, if it's going to be and continue to be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Now, as I say, there are some delicate negotiations that's carried on, where temporarily at least, I think the government has a right to keep them under its hat, but not for very long, and not to the extent this has been done. Now, in the case of the bombing of Cambodia, this was not only concealed, it was deliberately and fraudulently concealed by all kinds of double bookkeeping, by which it was indicated even to the members of Congress that the bombing was not going on in Cambodia, but was going on in Vietnam. People whose sons were killed in Cambodia were told that they died in Vietnam. There's no excuse for that kind of deception. The people down there who were being bombed knew they were being bombed. The deception was to prevent the mobilization of public opinion in the United States, and that was utterly unjustified.
Senator,
Because you've been such a leading and ranking Democrat for so many years, there probably aren't many people who realize that very early in your career you were a Republican. And as I read the book, I looked in vain for the precise transition point where you became a Democrat rather than a Republican. I was unable to find that precise transition.
Well, I think I was a Republican only because my father was, and he wasn't a very fervent one. And in fact, he was a mugwump. He voted for Grover Cleveland. And I think my first awareness was in the early teens when I was a bull moose and was voting for supporting Theodore Roosevelt and then Woodrow Wilson. But, of course, the great change came with Franklin Delano Roosevelt somewhat later. Because I think, in retrospect, I think we can say very definitely that the regimes in the 20s prior to Roosevelt, Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge, were not very stimulating or inspiring. And Herbert Hoover, whom a group of us had supported very fervently in 1920 when he came back from Europe as a food administrator and seemed like a great idealist, we lost faith in when he was unable to take the necessary steps to cope with the depression of the late 20s.
But you were a fan of Hoover's at one time.
I certainly was.
Me too.
Well, I think at that time he came back from Europe having been above the battle, having been not non-political, and having just fed people, and having done a great humanitarian piece of work. And he seemed to those of us, and I wasn't the only one.
You thought that if he had been president instead of Harding in that period, that history would have treated him well.
But when he came to a great crisis which he couldn't meet, of course he lost his stature and went down to defeat. And I think it was rather tragic because he was a very decent person, but he was limited in his vision. He wasn't able to take the drastic measures that had to be taken. The new ideas, I mean, which were considered socialistic and so forth, unemployment compensation, for instance, that was a very radical idea. People laughed at that. You know, imagine paying people for not working well. It's one of those ideas that's been gradually accepted. But I would say that today I would hope that both parties would develop a kind of leadership that the American people can trust. And we're waiting to see.
Joe, with that particular... Oh, yeah. I was particularly interested in your interaction as territorial governor, Senator, with the territorial legislature at that time. And through those years, I gathered the very distinct impression that you didn't have much respect for the territorial legislators by and large. You felt that they were largely dominated by the canned salmon industry, and particularly after the session of 1945, when the canned salmon lobby was so successful in beating back your proposed legislation for a progressive fish trap tax, and in reflecting upon the results of that session of 1945, you included a paragraph in which you talked about a half dozen of the legislators at that time. And clearly indicate that you felt that they had been bribed by the industry to oppose your progressive fish trap tax.
No question about it, they were.
And do you have any qualms, and I've noticed this in some other places throughout the book, do you have any qualms about the fact that this might be libelous?
Not the slightest. I'd be welcome a suit.
Larry, could we read this paragraph?
Yeah.
Libelous.
Incidentally, that's one, again, people don't like to hear the host of a show like this be so ingratiating, but your book is terribly candid. You know, some people can't bring themselves to do it, but you did, didn't you?
Well, I think I just stated the facts as they appeared to me. I mean, here we had them. You see, the setup in the legislature was such, as from the very beginning, when we were controlled by the absentee interest, which drafted the Organic Act, that a very small number of legislators could block legislation. And all they ever wanted to do was to block legislation. They weren't wanting to legislate. They wanted to stop anything that cost money. And so the Senate was set up with only 8 men, so that 4 men, if they could buy 4 men, they could block it. And really it was fewer than 4, it was 3, because after the 50th day, it required a 2/3 vote to move a bill from one house to the other. So that if they could just stall for 50 days, 3 men So the absentee canned salmon industry only had to buy three men, and they did. And I've named some of them, and one of them is still living in Fairbanks.
Read the paragraph, Joe, and then some callers have questions we better take care of.
And one of the reasons this portion of it fascinates me is because I think it's directly analogous to what's happening to us today. And I have some opinions on that, which I won't state at the moment. But that's why it fascinated me, because I do think there's a direct analogy that we can draw, and the history is repeating itself. The canned salmon industry's methods to influence other senators became clear after the 1945 legislative session. Ed Coffey, who had come to the House as a fisherman's candidate in 1937...